So, imagine you go to the grocery store, right? You buy all your groceries for the week, you pay at the register, and then you just immediately throw like 40% of that food directly into a dumpster before you even reach your car.
I mean, no one would ever do that.
No, it's completely nuts. But, well, that is exactly what is happening with treated water in South Africa every single day. Up to 40% of it, it just never reaches the tap.
It's a staggering reality to confront, honestly.
It really is. And so, welcome to our deep dive. Today, we have a clear mission for you listening. We are taking a really hard look at a comprehensive guide, and it's called Reducing Water Loss: Practical Approaches to Water Conservation and Demand Management. And we are going to explore this hidden crisis of urban water loss. We're using South Africa as our prime example today just to uncover the surprisingly high-tech and practical ways cities can actually save their most precious resource. Because whether you're a homeowner, an urban planner, or just, a curious mind, the sheer scale of this invisible waste is just, it's going to blow your mind.
Oh,
Yeah.
absolutely. When you hear a statistic like 40%, it forces a complete recalibration of how you view municipal infrastructure. I mean, especially in drought-prone regions like South Africa, where we are constantly talking about, water scarcity, climate
Like
volatility.
the urgent need for secure supply.
Exactly. But the conversation usually revolves around finding new water sources, like how do we get more?
Yeah.
But the guide we're looking at today, it kind of flips that narrative entirely. The most urgent intervention isn't necessarily finding new water. It's stopping this massive hemorrhage of the water we already have.
Okay, let's unpack this 40% number because there's a distinction the source material makes here that is, I think, absolutely crucial. We aren't talking about 40% of a wild river simply evaporating into the air.
No, not at all.
We're talking about treated water, like water that a municipality has already spent millions of dollars to extract, to filter, chemically treat, test, and then pump into the grid.
Right, and we connect this to the bigger picture. Losing treated water is, well, it's basically an economic and environmental tragedy.
Yeah, because it's not just water anymore.
Exactly. Think about the mechanics of water treatment. It is a highly industrial, energy-intensive process. You have these massive pumps pulling raw water from a reservoir or, an aquifer, and then it goes through all these complex filtration systems. It undergoes flocculation, where
Right, flocculation.
Flocculation, it's where chemicals are added to the water to bind all the tiny impurities together.
Right, so they clump up and you can physically remove them.
Exactly. And then, it's disinfected to make it biologically safe for human consumption. And after all that, the city uses just an enormous amount of electricity to pump that now heavy treated liquid under really high pressure through hundreds of miles of underground pipes.
Right. So when a pipe cracks and leaks into the surrounding soil, the city isn't just losing H2O. They are literally pouring electricity, chemical resources, and human labor into the dirt.
Precisely. The municipality is paying the full production cost for a product that generates zero revenue and, honestly, provides zero public benefit.
And it doesn't hit everyone equally.
No, the cascading effects of this loss hit the most vulnerable populations the hardest. The guide makes it very clear that when 40% of the water is just bleeding out of the system, the overall pressure of the entire grid drops.
Which means the people at the outer edges of the grid suffer the most. I mean, if you live right next to the municipal pumping station, you probably won't even notice a pressure drop.
Right, you'll have plenty of pressure.
But if you live in a marginalized community at the far end of the pipeline, or say in a neighborhood at a higher elevation, that loss of pressure means your tap simply runs dry.
And that is the daily reality for millions of people. It creates this artificial scarcity. But there is a very powerful counter-narrative here in the source.
Okay.
If a city can plug those leaks and reclaim even just half of that lost 40%, the benefits are immediate. I mean, you instantly improve the reliability of the supply for those vulnerable communities.
Right.
You drastically reduce the municipal energy bill. And crucially, you delay the need to build incredibly expensive new infrastructure.
Like a multi-billion-dollar desalination plant or something.
Exactly. Or a new dam. You just optimize what you already have.
Which brings us to the actual mechanics of why the system is failing in the first place, right? To stop the waste, we really have to understand the physical forces that are tearing these pipes apart from the inside.
Yeah, it's a brutal environment down there.
And the guide points to two major culprits here. aging infrastructure, and water pressure. And honestly, the section on water pressure really threw me.
How so?
Well, hold on. I'm just confused by this concept. Because as a consumer, you know, standing in my bathroom at 6 in the morning, I want high water pressure in my shower. Nobody wants a trickle.
Right, of course.
Are you telling me that the exact thing that gives me a good shower is what's destroying the municipal grid?
It is a fascinating paradox, but yeah, yes, high water pressure is basically the natural enemy of underground infrastructure. Cities have to perform this incredibly delicate balancing act.
Because they need enough force to get the water where it's going.
Exactly. They need enough hydraulic force to push water up to, say, the 5th floor of an apartment building. But every single ounce of that pressure is actively seeking a weak point in the system. The underground environment operates like a giant continuous pressure cooker.
It makes me think of a garden hose. Like, if you turn the spigot on your house just a quarter of the way and your hose has a tiny pinhole in it, it'll just form a slow, steady drip, right?
Right.
But if you crank that spigot all the way open and maximize the pressure, that exact same pinhole will suddenly spray a jet of water halfway across your lawn.
That is the perfect analogy for what is happening beneath our streets right now. The higher the pressure, the harder the water violently forces itself against every microscopic crack, every degrading joint, and every old valve.
Wow.
And remember, water usage isn't static. It fluctuates wildly throughout the day.
Because of human behavior.
Right. During the day, when everyone is washing dishes, doing laundry, and flushing toilets, the pressure in the municipal pipes actually drops because the water has places to exit.
Oh, that makes sense.
But at 3 in the morning, when the entire city is asleep and all of those taps are closed, the pressure inside those mains spikes dramatically.
Right.
And that is the exact moment when an aging, brittle cast iron pipe simply shatters under the stress.
So how does an urban planner even solve that? Because you can't just permanently lower the pressure and leave everyone with terrible showers all day. But you also obviously can't let the pipes explode every night at 3 a.m.
You solve it with dynamic, system-wide pressure management.
Okay.
The guide outlines the use of smart pressure-reducing valves. So these aren't the static, manual valves of the past where a guy goes down with a wrench.
Right.
These are intelligent, automated valves that constantly adjust the flow based on real-time demand. So at 3 a.m., when the system senses that demand has plummeted, the smart valves automatically throttle the pressure down, just releasing that stress on the old pipes.
And then at 6 a.m., as people start waking up,
the valves gradually open up again to ensure you get that high-pressure shower.
That's brilliant. It buys the city time. But eventually, you actually have to replace the decaying pipes themselves.
Right? You do, yeah. The smart valves just extend their lifespan.
Right. And the guide talks a lot about upgrading old infrastructure and specifically mentions moving to materials like HDPE, which is high-density polyethylene pipes. So why is that specific material such a game changer for water loss?
Well, what's fascinating here is the shift in material science. For over a century, cities relied on rigid materials. We're talking cast iron or concrete.
Which seem really strong.
They are strong, but they are incredibly brittle, and they corrode over time. So when the ground shifts, whether due to temperature changes or just heavy traffic above, or when that 3 a.m. water hammer hits, a rigid iron pipe cracks.
Right.
HDPE, on the other hand, fundamentally changes the physics of the pipe. It is a highly engineered thermoplastic. At a molecular level, the polymer chains actually allow the pipe to be flexible.
So it can literally absorb the physical shock instead of fighting it.
Exactly. When a pressure spike hits an HDPE pipe, the material can expand slightly to accommodate the force and then just return to its original shape.
That is wild.
Yeah, and it doesn't corrode. It doesn't rust. Plus, because the joints are typically fused together with heat rather than using mechanical fittings, they basically form one continuous seamless tube that is virtually leak-proof.
Okay, so a city is installing smart valves to manage the nighttime pressure spikes, and they are slowly swapping out the brittle iron for flexible HDPE. But that transition, I mean, that has to take decades for a major metropolis, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's a massive, multi-generational project.
So in the meantime, you still have millions of gallons of treated water escaping into the soil from pipes that are buried under 3 feet of concrete. And this, the transition from physical pipes to the digital technology tracking the water, this is where the guide really blew my mind.
It is a complete paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Historically, water management was entirely reactive. Like, a utility company only knew they had a severe leak when water literally bubbled out through the asphalt and flooded an intersection.
Or when an entire neighborhood called to complain that their taps were dry.
Exactly. And by that point, the pipe had already failed catastrophically.
But today, Our water grids are essentially functioning like massive subterranean nervous systems.
They really are.
And here's where it gets really interesting. The guide breaks down how cities use remote data loggers, acoustic sensors, and GIS mapping to find leaks before they ever reach the surface. Let's walk through how this digital nervous system actually operates in the real world.
Okay, think of the acoustic sensors and data loggers as the nerve endings of the city.
Okay.
These devices are attached to pipes, valves, and hydrants all over the grid. An acoustic sensor literally listens to the physical vibrations of the pipe, because when water escapes through a crack under high pressure, it generates a very specific high-frequency hissing sound.
Wait, the sensor can hear the leak even if the pipe is buried under a highway?
Yes, through feet of dirt and concrete. And these nerve endings are constantly feeding data back to the brain of the operation, which is the GIS, the Geographic Information System.
Right.
The GIS is essentially a highly detailed digital map of the entire physical water network, and it's layered with real-time flow and acoustic data.
So, put us in the control room. What does this look like for the person actually managing the grid?
Okay, so imagine it's 3.15 a.m. A control room operator is looking at the GIS interface. Suddenly, an anomaly appears on the screen in, say, Zone 4 of the city. A cluster of remote data loggers is reporting an unexpected sustained flow of water, and an acoustic sensor is picking up the high-frequency vibration of a leak.
Wow.
The operator knows that nobody in that specific residential block should be drawing that much water at 3 in the morning.
And without this system, that leak might run for months, just silently washing away the soil underground until a massive sinkhole forms.
Exactly. But with the GIS mapping, the system removes all the guesswork. The operator doesn't just know there is a leak somewhere in a 3-mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
The software triangulates the data and drops a red pin on the digital map with exact GPS coordinates.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so the utility can dispatch a repair crew the very next morning to dig a single, precise hole and patch the pipe before it ever becomes a catastrophic visible failure.
That top-down citywide surveillance is just incredible. But the digital revolution doesn't stop at the municipal control room, does it?
No, not at all.
Because the guide also heavily emphasizes how this technology crosses the property line and enters your home, the listener's home, through smart meters. How does a smart meter change the game for an everyday household compared to, you know, the old spinning dials we grew up with?
Well, a traditional analog water meter is essentially just a cash register.
Mm-hmm.
A municipal worker walks by your house once a month, reads the total number, and they send you a bill.
Right.
It tells you absolutely nothing about how you actually use your water. A smart meter, however, is a diagnostic tool. It measures your household water consumption in real time, often down to the gallon, and it sends that data directly to an app on your phone and to the utility company.
So it establishes a baseline for your specific household's behavior.
It does. So let's say you have an underground irrigation system for your garden, and a tiny joint in one of the buried PVC pipes breaks. With a traditional meter, you wouldn't know about that silent underground leak until you received an astronomically high water bill 4 weeks later, by which point thousands of gallons have been wasted.
Right, you're just paying for wasted water.
But with a smart meter, the system detects that your home has been continuously pulling water for 48 hours straight. It instantly sends a push notification to your phone, alerting you to a potential leak, allowing you to shut off the main valve and fix the problem the exact same day.
Which brings up a really critical juncture in this whole conversation. Because the city can deploy all the acoustic sensors, GIS maps, and smart valves in the world, but their control firmly stops at your property line.
Yes.
Once the water enters your home, it is entirely in your hands. We can engineer the most brilliant automated water network on the planet, but if the end user is negligent, the resource is still wasted. So what does this all mean for you listening to this right now?
It means that infrastructure alone simply cannot solve a water crisis.
Yeah.
The guide dedicates a really significant focus to educating and involving communities. Because while finding a massive main break with an acoustic sensor is vital, the aggregate data of human habits is just as powerful.
And we aren't just talking about individual blame here, right? We are talking about cumulative mathematics. Like a single dripping tap in a guest bathroom might waste a few gallons a day. But if you have a city of 3 million people and 10% of those homes have a constantly running toilet or a dripping faucet,
you are losing millions of gallons of highly treated, incredibly expensive water every single week.
Yeah.
Entirely on the consumer side of the meter.
It's staggering.
That is the invisible drain on the system.
Yeah.
And beyond just fixing leaks, there is a fundamental philosophy outlined in the source material. Water cannot be replaced, but it can be reused. Community involvement isn't just about, you know, grabbing a wrench. It's about rethinking how we design our living spaces.
Right. And the guide brings up a company called Resolve in this context. And what I found really compelling wasn't just their name, but the specific engineering approach they take to this problem, because they focus on designing practical, localized solutions that bridge the gap between the massive municipal infrastructure and everyday consumer usage.
Yeah, Resolve is a prime example of applying systemic thinking to local environments. Mm-hmm. They don't just tell communities, hey, use less water.
Right.
They engineer systems that actually allow for water reuse. This is a critical mechanism for demand management, because right now we use pristine drinking quality water for almost everything, which is incredibly inefficient.
Right. I mean, we are literally flushing our toilets and watering our lawns with water that has been chemically treated to be safe enough to drink. It makes no sense when you really think about it.
It is an immense waste of processing power. So organizations like Resolve implement systems that separate and treat gray water.
And just to clarify, gray water is...
Gray water is the gently used water from your bathroom sinks, your showers, and washing machines. So instead of sending that water directly into the sewer system, localized reuse mechanisms filter it on site.
Wow.
It doesn't need to be treated to the high standard of drinking water. It just needs to be safe enough to be redirected into, say, irrigation systems for parks, or cooling towers for local industries, or even plumbed right back into residential toilets.
So by reusing the gray water, you are drastically cutting down the demand on the municipal supply.
Exactly.
You are leaving the pristine treated water for actual human consumption and using the recycled water for the heavy lifting.
And when you combine that localized engineering with active public participation like homeowners, choosing drought-resistant, water-wise plants instead of trying to maintain a lush, thirsty green lawn in the middle of a dry climate, you create genuine resilience. It's a true partnership.
The city uses GIS mapping to protect the mains, and the community actively manages their own demand and reuses what they can. Okay, so we've covered a lot. We've covered the vast scope of this invisible hemorrhage, the physics of water pressure tearing pipes apart, the molecular flexibility of HDPE, the digital nervous system of acoustic sensors, and the mechanics of local water reuse.
We really have.
So let's synthesize all of this. When a city actually commits to this multi-tiered approach, what is the ripple effect? I mean, beyond just a slightly lower utility bill for the homeowner, what are the ultimate systemic benefits of mastering demand management?
The benefits radiate outward to reshape the entire socioeconomic and environmental landscape. First, you achieve intense drought resilience.
Okay.
If a city is losing 40% of its water, a minor drought instantly becomes a catastrophic emergency. But a highly efficient, tightly monitored grid with active gray water reuse, well, they can weather a prolonged dry season without having to impose draconian water cuts on its citizens.
Because they have built a buffer into the system simply by not wasting what they already have.
Exactly. And that leads directly to profound environmental relief. Think about the source of the water. If a utility needs to deliver 100 million gallons to its citizens, but it loses 40% in transit,
they have to pull way more out of nature.
Right. It has to extract nearly 170 million gallons from the natural environment just to meet the baseline demand. So by sealing the system and managing demand, we leave tens of millions of gallons of water in the rivers, in the lakes, and aquifers.
Wow.
That preserves biodiversity. It keeps local ecosystems thriving instead of draining them dry.
And as we touched on earlier, the social justice implications are arguably the most impactful outcome of this entire process.
They absolutely are. A leaky, inefficient system is inherently inequitable. It disproportionately punishes marginalized communities at the far reaches of the grid.
Right.
By fixing the infrastructure and stabilizing the hydraulic pressure citywide, you ensure that every community, regardless of their zip code, their elevation, or their distance from the pumping station, has fair and reliable access to clean water.
You move water from being a scarce commodity fought over during a crisis back to being a fundamental human right that is reliably delivered.
Yes, it requires a monumental shift in how we value every single drop. It proves that conservation isn't just a defensive strategy against drought. It is a proactive investment in the future of the city.
I love that. And that brings us to the end of our deep dive today. Thank you so much for joining us as we explored the incredible hidden world of water conservation, from the intense pressures of the underground mains to the digital maps guiding our cities. We have unpacked a lot of complex mechanics today.
We certainly have.
But before you go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over on your own. Throughout our lives, we are conditioned to think of the water coming out of our taps as a raw, natural resource. It feels elemental, you know, like it just flows freely from a mountain stream directly into our homes. But considering the immense scale of what we'd have discussed today, the massive electrical pumps, the chemical flocculation, the molecularly engineered polymer pipes, the acoustic sensors, and the real-time geographic data required just to get it to your house, what if we stopped viewing tap water as a natural resource and started viewing it as a highly engineered manufactured product? How would that change the way you value the water running down your drain while you brush your teeth tonight? Something to think about. Until next time.